Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to our study of Christian evidences. I wouldn't have thought that we would have 4 inches of rain in the forecast for a single day. If I had thought about it last week, nor would I have thought that my thermometer would have read 53 degrees this morning after the recent temperatures we've had. But it's been quite a change for us, and that's to be expected, I guess. But good morning and welcome. I want to bring us back to the slide we almost always start with, which is something like this, and kind of remind ourselves of where we've been and where we're going, and where how what we're going to talk about today fits in to our study overall. So we're talking about the basic affirmation of Christianity. That is, why is it reasonable to believe that Christianity is true? Why is it reasonable to believe the teachings of Christianity are true? You can't answer that question just by appealing to the Bible, any more than I can be certain that the religion of Islam is true by an appeal to the Quran. That does not follow. Any book, any writing can claim whatever it wants to. That doesn't make it true in and of itself. And so we look for a rational justification of the truthfulness of some belief system, and we have come to the conclusion that Christianity is the true and only true belief system. But as we do that, we have to make a couple of arguments, or at least establish a couple of premises with arguments. The first of those is that God exists. After that, we argue that the Bible is indeed from God and inspired and what it claims to be. And then it's just one step further to know that Christianity is true. That is, if the Bible teaches this Bible that is from God, who exists and who is all powerful and all good and all truthful, if the Bible teaches a particular conclusion, then that conclusion is true. And that's a perfectly rational, valid argument to make. And that's one way to organize your thinking, or my thinking, about the Christian point of view. Inside of there, we're studying the teleological argument. And teleological arguments have to do with order, an organization, an arrangement in the universe. And that's where we are now. Now, inside of that, and these things are nested, I guess, inside of that, is a study of specific areas of organization. So we study and have studied the three things you see up on your screen. We're looking at the fundamental laws of physics and how they were fine-tuned. We talked about those 2 weeks ago. Last week we studied the non-living realm, the organization in particular of our solar system and the planets. Now, the fact that water is on the earth, water has properties that are absolutely essential to life and stability of life. Today we want to focus in on the living realm, that is, the world of the study of biology, you might say, the realm of life. We want to look at the realm of life for an indication of order and complexity. Now, at the end of the day, I have to admit that I feel like this is almost a tongue-in-cheek kind of conversation. Because to ask the question, is life complex, is to ask a question that almost answers itself before we get off the ground. The complexity of life has been understood for generations, long before you and I ever came on the scene. And with scientific advancement and study and further comprehension of life itself, as we grow in our knowledge, we are only more and more impressed with its inherent complexity. The further we go down the rabbit hole, the deeper we learn that it goes. As we get into things, I want to turn to Psalm 8. Psalm 8 has just a few verses in it, and we'll read just a couple of those. But Psalm 8 orients us toward the creation of God. Listen, please, to a couple of verses from Psalm 8. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth, who have set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouths of babes and nursing infants you have ordained strength because of your enemies, that you may silence the enemy and the avenger. Now listen to verse 3. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? For you have made him for a little while lower than the angels. You have made him a little lower than the angels, and have crowned him with glory and honor. You have made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet. When I read through that short passage, in particular verses 3 through 5 there, I see the psalmist, if I'm understanding things correctly, say two things. In the first place, he recognizes God, O Lord, our Lord. And he recognizes God's supremacy. But then he dwells for a minute, or maybe an hour, on the heavens that God has created. He looks out into the heavens, and he is just in awe of the expanse, of the vastness, of the amazing greatness of the heavens that we see when we look out in the night sky. But then, while he's contemplating the heavens, he draws his attention to man. And by contrast, he seems to be saying in verses 3 and 4, by contrast, man is not so worthy of God's attention. When I look at the vastness of the heavens and the sky and so forth that God has created, man seems unbelievably insignificant by contrast. But then notice what happens in the next verse. In the next verse, it's almost like he turns that upside down, and he talks about the grand position that God has given to man. That is, God has set man over his creation. Verse 6, you've given him dominion over the works of your hands. All things of the creation have been placed under his feet. Even there, you might assume, the heavens. And so in the first place, we have the heavens in the grand position, and then man sort of insignificant by comparison. But then later it is one verse later, that's turned upside down. Now man is at the pinnacle of God's creation, even above the heavens. Now I wonder if maybe the psalmist's mood determined how he thought about that. Maybe one day or one moment he would think that the heavens are by far greater than man in significance and impressiveness. And then maybe a moment later, he recognizes and is thinking about things in a different way. And he imagines man to be greater than the heavens in some sense. But whatever the case may be, we have a stark contrast between the biblical view and the atheistic or secular view of these three objects: God, the heavens, and man. In the biblical view, God is the source of both of these things, not to mention the remainder of creation. God is the source, God is the cause, God is the impetus that brings these things into being. In the atheistic worldview, we start with the heavens. Now, going back for a minute to the cosmological argument that we talked about weeks ago, we have to ask what question about the heavens? Where did they come from? Okay, so there's a causal question that's altogether unanswered, and we've talked about that already. Where did the heavens come from, if we're thinking of the atheistic viewpoint? But once we have the heavens, so we ignore that fact and just move on. Once we have the heavens, the atheistic view is, at least from one perspective, is that they created man. You might imagine the Big Bang occurs, and then the planets start to cool, and solar systems form, and all of this. And then eventually that brings about, by processes of evolution, the existence of life, and then man. Man, then, in the atheistic view, is the originator of God, or at least the idea of God under the atheistic view. And so there could not be a greater contrast between these two views. The causal relationships are entirely inverted as you go from one to the other. And that's what we want to think about a little bit today. In particular, we want to focus on what's in the box here. The idea that the heavens could somehow create the order that leads not only to man, but to life in general. Is that a reasonable position to take, or is it more reasonable to assume that God is the source of life, and that's where we want to go? We talked not long ago about the law of rationality, and I just want to remind you of that briefly. If I want to be a rational person and I'm trying to answer a question, the only way to approach that question and claim to be rational is if I will accept only the conclusions that are warranted by the evidence. That is, I want to make a decision about whether it's more reasonable that the order and arrangement and complexity of life started with God, or is it more reasonable that the origin, complexity, order, arrangement of life came about as a result of chance, random processes? Which of those two options is more reasonable? The way we have to approach this to be rational is to gather all relevant evidence, at least to the best of our ability. Okay? All evidence is perhaps not accessible to us, but we gather all of the evidence that we possibly can. We search, we research and study, and then we handle the evidence correctly. We're honest about the process, and we use logic to the best of our ability. So I want to think then for a minute about the complexity of life. And we're looking, as we study here, for order and arrangement and the appearance of design in the physical realm of life. So I want to start out by looking at some of the details, okay? And this involves a progression, I think, from what we see when we look under the microscope at a cell, or when we look at an ecosystem that involves rabbits and foxes and rodents and all of these animals that make up an ecosystem and their environments and so forth. We want to progress from that level, and first of all, notice that that level depends on the foundation that comes before that we've talked about already in this class. So the study of life is biology, and under that heading, we study all living organisms, and those are interesting objects of study. The definition of life is something that's capable of growth, self-reproduction, metabolism. It is cell-based. There are no known exceptions to that, that all of life at its most basic unit is composed of cells, either one cell organism or multicellular organisms. It possesses something called homeostasis, which means if, for example, my body temperature gets too high, there's a mechanism in my body that causes me to cool off and brings me back to an equilibrium. Sweating is an example of a homeostasis sort of mechanism, and so forth. So there are various aspects involved in a definition of life, but we certainly know it when we see it. Biology, though, at its most basic level, is, I want to say, just chemistry, but it's based on the foundation of chemistry, chemical interactions. And Reed is here today, and so I can refer to him as the expert chemist among us, maybe. Chemistry involves molecular interactions, a study of formation of chemical bonds between atoms, and consequences of those bonds. Cells are composed of molecules, and molecules interact according to laws and principles of chemistry. Now, we recognize when we study the chemistry of life that the molecules themselves are incredibly complex. And we'll talk about this as we go on, but the molecules that make up life, that perform the functions of life, are incredibly complex, to say nothing of the interactions between these complex molecules. Okay, so we'll try to get some glimpse of that as we go forward and try to have some appreciation of what's going on at the chemical level. But chemistry, at its basic level, is what? Well, it's governed by the laws of physics. Okay, we're dealing with laws of electrical attraction. Okay, that has to do with the fundamental physics of nature. Positives and negatives attract. There are magnetic interactions. There are gravitational interactions. Okay, there are principles that involve how an electron goes around an atom. Okay, and all of those things are involved ultimately in a study of biology. But the point I want to make here briefly is that this brings us all the way back. A study of life and understanding life brings us all the way back to the issue of the fine-tuning of the fundamental constants of the universe. the ideas of gravitation and electromagnetism and all of these things that we talked about being finely tuned. And this gives us an idea, I think, of why the fine tuning is so important. The laws of physics that govern the chemical reactions inside of our cells in our body are the same laws of physics that govern the attraction of the Earth to the Sun, which is a fantastically greater scale of attraction. And so the fine-tuning means that in the same universe, both of those things can work. We have proteins and DNA and cellular organelle that we'll talk about in a minute interacting with one another on a chemical level, governed by the same laws of physics that hold us onto the planet, that hold us down by gravity. These same laws operate in both arenas. And so that it gives me a sense of why this fine-tuning is so important. So we're studying biology, which is based on chemistry, which is based on physics, which I would say is based on math, but I'm not going to go there. But so all of these things bring us down to the very basic, the very fundamental level of the way God has set up the universe. But let's dig in a little bit to some of the details, just briefly, and talk for a minute about the cell. The cell is the unit of life, and a cell is not so obscure from us as you might think. For, let's say, $100, less than $100 if you buy a used one, you can buy a microscope that will let you take your own skin cells, your own cells out of the inside of your mouth, is a common cell to study, put it on a slide and look at it. You can actually see it. It's invisible to the naked eye, but with a not-so-expensive microscope, you can see individual cells of your body and my body. This is what we are made up of, at least in the physical realm. The size of human cells varies. They are very, very small, though, in all cases, at least relative to our experience. The largest human cell is an egg cell, and it is 5/1000ths of an inch across, still invisible to the naked eye. 5/1000ths, 5/1000ths of an inch across. A smaller cell is the red blood cell. It has a diameter that is from one side of the cell to the other side of about 3/10000ths of an inch. That is unimaginably small, or almost unimaginably small. 3/10000ths of an inch. Divide an inch into 10,000 equal pieces and take three of them. The smallest human cell, it's been said, is so small that 20,000 of them could fit inside of the capital letter O in a standard typewriter font. 20,000 of them inside of a standard capital letter O. Imagine the size of such a small object. But the fact that it's small masks the incredible functions that it carries out. Inside of the cell, a living cell, there is a whole world of life, activity, communication, signaling, processing, a whole life, a whole world of function inside of this microscopic little object. The cell can be organized in a couple of by looking at from a couple of angles. First of all, you have the cell membrane, which is the boundary of the cell. It separates the inside from the outside, so it holds the cell together. It gives its constitution so that we have what's inside protected from the environment outside of it. That's called the cell membrane. Now, I have to move on, but Reed or someone else could tell us for hours about the complexity of the cell membrane itself. So we're talking simply about the boundary that wraps around the cell. And here's one of the reasons why it has to be complex. First of all, it has to be able to build itself without any person exerting effort in the process of its development. So it's self-developing and self-stable. Another reason it's amazing and complex is because it's able to not just keep everything on the inside, it's able to allow what needs to come from the outside to the inside to do so. And it's able to allow what's inside, in particular waste products, to get outside of the cell. So it allows transport across the membrane. Some things cannot get out, should not get out, Some things must get out for the life and continued life of the cell. So the membrane is an incredibly complex part of the cell, but it's just the boundary. Coming inside of the cell, you come to something called the cytoplasm, which is a generic name for all of the stuff inside of the cell. It's primarily a watery, liquid-like substance that's fluid, but it at the same time supports the cell organelle that perform the functions of the cell. The cytoplasm is responsible for energy management. By the way, nothing happens in the physical universe unless there's energy to make it happen. The cell knows that, and the cell accommodates that and makes things happen by managing its energy. It communicates. One part of the cell communicates with another part of the cell. When a need arises, that need has to be communicated to the part of the cell that's able to deal with the issue, and then something occurs to meet the need. Transport is a part of the cytoplasm. Cytoplasm is responsible for cell repair. It's responsible, it's where reproduction of the cell occurs, and so forth. Many other functions are involved here. We're just skimming the surface. The nucleus is something like the information or processing center of the cell. It contains, in cells that have a nucleus, it contains the DNA of the cell and many other things as well. Some of the organelle or parts of the cell that live in the cytoplasm are these. And again, many of you know more about these things and have studied them in school more recently than me. But let's just give a quick overview of some of the things that that are inside of our cells. First of all, we have what are called mitochondria, which produce energy that's used for the cell. In particular, ATP molecules are created and then transported to where they may be needed by the mitochondria. Ribosomes are responsible for producing proteins in the cell. The cytoplasm we've already talked about. Vacuoles are storage bins that are used for transport. A vacuole is basically a little cell membrane that encloses a space. A vacuum of space is where the name comes from. And inside of these little bins, these closed loops, are either waste products that need to be carried to the cell membrane and then shot outside of the cell, or used for transport of nutrients and food and so forth from one part of the cell to the other. The endoplasmic reticulum folds proteins. So once the protein is produced, it's folded into the appropriate configuration so that it can perform whatever function it needs to perform and so forth. And this is just a short list of dozens of cellular organelle that are responsible for the life of the cell. But let's zero in just a little bit more on the nucleus for a minute. And this really, I think, is the place to start if you want to understand cellular goings-on and behavior. In the nucleus of the cell, we have the organism's DNA. And DNA is, as you know, the information conducts, is responsible for the reproduction of the cell, for all of the processes that go on in the cell, is the information for all of the functions of the cell. Without the DNA, the organism could not do anything. It would be unable to carry out any of its functions. This is something like the shape of the DNA, which you've heard of as being this double helix kind of shape, where two spirals are wrapped around one another, and in between the spirals are these what are called base pairs that are connected to one another, and those base pairs constitute the letters of an alphabet, a genetic alphabet, that that contains the instructions for the various functions that the cell needs to carry out. So around this double helix, one at a time, we have letters, chemical letters, that store information as you go along the helix. Now, it's an understatement to say that a lot can be said about DNA. And part of the reason it's an understatement is because DNA is only partially understood. We study it. We look at it under microscopes. We have some idea of its function. We understand something about gene theory and genetics and so forth. This is where all of that takes place. But there is a lot that is not understood at all about the function of DNA and just how it regulates the cell's functions. As far as the information content, the DNA of a human cell contains 3.1 billion of these base pairs. So the base pairs are these letters that we saw wound around the double helix pair. Sections of the DNA are then read and transcribed, and then that section of DNA, after it's been copied, is carried away, transported to the ribosomes, where the ribosomes convert that strand, that subsection of DNA, into a protein in a process that's called translation. But the level of coordination that's involved in producing a protein, to my mind, cannot be overstated. What has to happen for a protein to be created from the information of the DNA? Think about it. First of all, before you'd want to produce any particular protein inside of the cell, there has to be a need that arises in some portion of the cell. Okay, so maybe that happens, say, on the left side of the cell. Some need arises. That need has to automatically generate some signal that's transported to the nucleus, okay? Some signal that's specific to the need so that the appropriate protein is produced. That signal has to be transported to the nucleus, has to be received by the nucleus, so that inside of the nucleus, the DNA can be selected and the right piece of the DNA can be selected so that it can be copied to produce the appropriate protein that fulfills the need over here. So we have some protein need, some signal is sent, the appropriate portion of the DNA molecule is unwound and copied out, okay? And then that strand of copied DNA is carried to a ribosome where it's turned into or converted into just the right protein. And after the string of protein has been created, that string is carried to another organelle to fold the protein into an appropriate three-dimensional structure so that it can do what it needs to do back in the left side of the cell, let's say. Okay. All of those things have to happen on their own. They have to happen in a coordinated way, one right after the other. The order can't be swapped. And those things have to occur without any input from the outside intelligence. Those are automatic features that are built into the cell. Proteins, we've been talking about proteins for a while, and let's just say a quick word about them. The average length of a protein is about 400 amino acids. An amino acid is a chemical that corresponds to three of the letters in DNA. Okay, and I apologize for the technical nature of this, but in our DNA we have sequences of three letters at a time, and each of those three-letter pairs code for one of 20 different amino acids. The average length of a protein is about 400 of these amino acids, okay? And those, the particular sequence and order and particular chemical amino acid in each position gives the protein its chemical properties. So whatever properties it's going to have, whatever function, therefore, it will be able to fulfill, depends on the order and the selection of those amino acids. The particular choice of amino acids that's determined, by the way, by the information in the DNA, determines its three-dimensional folded shape. It determines its regions of electrical charge. It determines any particular handles that the protein might have that are latched onto by other proteins or ways in which the protein can grip another molecule inside of the cell, and so forth. So that the sequence of amino acids, the order of the amino acids, determines what the function of the protein ultimately will be. Okay, so we'll come back to proteins in a minute. But I wanted to think for just a couple of minutes with you about properties of DNA that are truly, truly astounding, at least to my mind. First of all, DNA of an organism contains all the information not only to perform the functions that the cell needs to perform, but also all of the information to self-replicate. It's able to reproduce a copy of itself. And I was trying to think of an analogy that gives a picture of what is going on, what the relationship between the instructions in the DNA and the cell are like. And the analogy might be something like this, although this analogy will certainly break down at multiple points. But imagine you have a camera, say a digital camera or a non-digital camera, it doesn't matter. But imagine you have a camera, and then you have an instruction manual for how to build the camera. Okay, how to build the camera. Imagine what that instruction manual would look like. To build a, say, a digital camera from scratch, you have a list of instructions that says, first do this, then do this. If you run into this problem, do this. You have to specify the sizes of the parts. You have to specify the materials out of which the parts are made. You have to specify the order in which the parts are put together. You have to specify again and again multiple levels of complexity as you go down the line. But it's actually more than that. So to specify the instructions required to make a digital camera, remember that you have to include all of the machinery that's involved in bringing these parts together. The parts of the camera don't assemble themselves. There's no production line to which you can go to someone and hand them the manual and then say, produce this camera based on these instructions. That's not allowed. That's not what the cell has no recourse to an assembly line and someone who can intelligently put the things where they need to go. The cell has to do it all by itself. So in that instruction manual, not only do you have to have directions for making the camera, you have to have directions for the factories that produce the parts that go into the camera. You have to have directions for the factories that produce the parts that assemble the parts that produce the camera. The complexity is truly, truly staggering, and it's what you might call a super property of DNA. Not only does it have to tell you how to make all the stuff, not only does it tell you what all has to be made, it has to tell you how to make everything that has to be made, and it has to tell you how to make the parts that have to be made. The complexity is truly incredible. Another super property of DNA, which again is this information content that gives the instructions for a cell, another aspect of it is compression. DNA is incredibly complex in more than one way. It's been said that if you were to stretch out from end to end these 3.1 billion base pairs in the human genome, that they would stretch out, if you could stretch out the strand of DNA, it would be over 6 feet in length. 6 feet in length. That's a single molecule that would stretch out to be over 6 feet in length. But that 6 foot in length linear list of letters in our genetic alphabet, okay, has to be contained and is contained in the nucleus of every single one of our cells. So that 6 foot long object containing 3.1 billion letters has to be somehow compressed to fit inside the nucleus of a cell, which by the way is much smaller than the cell itself. And so somehow it has to be compressed. How would you go about doing that? How would you take a string of 3.1 billion objects and compress them, squeeze them down, in a way, by the way, that has to be indexed, so that if you need to access a certain portion of the DNA, you can get to it when you need to make a particular protein and so forth. The way the cell accomplishes this is by using multiple levels of winding and twisting an organization so that the DNA can be compressed into a small space in a way that's still accessible whenever you need to access row 3021 and column 9 million or whatever the case may be. So the data compression that's involved here is truly, truly astounding. Okay, so I'd like to bring this kind of up a level and come into more common experience and talk about a couple of popular proteins, just two. The first one is insulin. Insulin is a protein that exists in our body. It's produced by ribosomes according to the letters of the DNA as they are translated. So insulin is a relatively short protein. Contains 51 amino acids, and it regulates blood sugar levels. Blood sugar levels, as we know, and some of us know more than others. The question I want to think about for a minute is, how likely would it be to construct the insulin molecule? It is a molecule, it's a protein. How likely would it be to construct the insulin molecule by randomly selecting 1 out of 20 amino acids in 51 positions? So 1 out of 20 options here, that's independent from 1 out of 20 options here, and so forth down the line, 51 times. Again, this is a short protein. How likely would it be to produce that molecule? Now, the reason this is an important question is because the function that insulin performs is critical to the regulation of sugar in the bloodstream. And without this molecule, dire consequences ensue. The question then becomes, in my mind, how many other sequences of amino acids could accomplish the same task? That is, of all the possible options of ways I could line up 51 amino acids, how many of those would accomplish the function, the very specific function that insulin accomplishes? The picture is something like this. Again, we know it. We know these things at the top. The assumption that we make, again, is that the choice of amino acids, as we're choosing these things, we're trying to imagine randomly producing an insulin molecule. The assumption we make is that each choice is independent from the next one. Just like flipping a coin again and again, the flip, the outcome of that flip, of that coin toss, is independent from the outcome on the next coin toss. So if we assume independence, the calculation would be something like one chance out of 10 to the 67th power, or a 1 with 67 zeros following it, an unimaginably vast number. 1 out of 1 followed by 67 zeros is an unimaginably small number. That says something about how special the insulin molecule, the insulin protein is. But let's talk about just one other quickly. Hemoglobin is another protein which is responsible, if you see the root there, is responsible for regulation of oxygen and the transport of oxygen from our lungs to the rest of our bodies. The air in your body only directly contacts your lungs. When I breathe in, I'm taking in some of the atmosphere, but that atmosphere is limited to my lungs. Somehow, the oxygen needs to get to the rest of my body. Hemoglobin is largely responsible for that. It's an average size protein at about 430 amino acids, give or take a couple. Hemoglobin constitutes 95%, the bulk, of the dry weight of a red blood cell. So if you were to dry a red blood cell out, it would be 95% by weight hemoglobin. Hemoglobin carries oxygen from the lungs to the body via the red blood cell. So the hemoglobin, again, constitutes almost all of the red blood cell. Each hemoglobin protein can carry 4 oxygen molecules on it, and there are hundreds of millions of hemoglobin molecules in each red blood cell. And this is what makes really life possible in an organism with a body the size of ours. Oxygen, of course, is the most important fuel of cellular respiration. It is a power generator. Oxygen essentially burns inside of our bodies in a sense that it reacts quickly and gives off a lot of energy in the process. And so oxygen is absolutely necessary for the function of cellular respiration and is involved in energy production in the cell. But I want to notice again how incredibly ordered and organized and well-arranged what's going on in our cells, this one little small component of our bodies. Sickle cell anemia is a disease that affects a small percentage of the population, but a percentage nonetheless. And sickle cell anemia is the consequence of a single change in DNA. Now remember, the DNA is the information that's used to transcribe, to produce the protein. In position number 6, so the 6th protein in this 430 amino acid chain, the 6th amino acid is replaced. So there's an error in the DNA, a mutation in the DNA, which leads to a change in the translation process so that the wrong amino acid is put in position 6. The normal amino acid is glutamic acid, if I'm pronouncing that right, and that's replaced by something called valine. In a single position, every other position is correct. Mutant hemoglobin causes dramatically deformed red blood cells. They have a sickle shape and appearance, or a half moon sort of crescent shape, many of the red blood cells, and they're dramatically deformed, and this causes dramatic consequences in the person who suffers from this mutation. They have a decreased oxygen carrying capacity, which causes pain in the extremities, highly increased risk of stroke, and even with modern medicine, modern treatment, in modern times, there is a expected lifespan of around 50 years. And so, in days gone by, that lifespan was down in the order of the 20s and 30s. And so a single change in this one protein has enormous effects. And we could look at literally hundreds of other examples where the smallest of errors, the smallest of changes to this highly precise molecule, highly precise protein that performs a highly precise function has deadly consequences, dramatic consequences. But if you talk about cells and you leave the conversation, if you leave the discussion there, you ignore the majority of the picture, you might say, because we're not cells. We are systems of cells that have to interact with one another. The human body is said to contain some 30 trillion cells, which is a number that's unimaginably large, really. I guess you can think about the national debt. When I think of trillions, I think in terms of our national debt, which I know is enormously large. But to really wrap my mind around what 1 trillion means is very difficult. A trillion is 1,000 billions, and 1 billion is 1,000 millions, and 1 million is 1,000 thousands. And so the size of such a number is vast. And every one of our bodies contain in the neighborhood of 30 trillion cells. There are about 50 different types of cells, neurons in our brains and nervous systems, red blood cells, as we've already talked about. Our muscle tendons are comprised of muscle cells, and so on and so forth. Reproductive cells, and on the order of 50 different kinds of cells, ranging in size and function. But the cells themselves, sounded strange, the cells themselves organize to form tissues, and then organs, and then systems, all the way up to the organism. And so the complexity is incredibly high. We'll leave it with this. Something we should think about is if any of the byproducts of a cellular function in one system caused a negative impact on another part of the system, life would be impossible. And so all of these things have to be coordinated and work together. We'll pick up with this next time and try to wrap up as quickly as we possibly can. Thank you very much.